I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. There are few defenders of human genetic engineering who have been vilified as thoroughly and as often as Professor Lee Silver of Princeton University, who wrote a book back in the 1990s called Remaking Eden, in which he called for the use of human genetic engineering and the inevitability of it, and tried to talk about some of the policy consequences of it. In his latest book, he responds to some of the debates that have occurred in the last 10 years around biotechnology, and it's a fascinating read. We'll be talking with him about that today. So stay tuned for Professor Lee Silver talking about his book, Challenging Nature, The Clash of Science and Spirituality at the New Frontiers of Life. I'm speaking today with Lee Silver. Dr. Lee Silver is a professor at Princeton University in the Department of Molecular Biology and the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Dr. Silver's previous book is, one of his previous books is Remaking Eden, How Genetic Engineering and Cloning Will Transform the American Family. And in that, he argued for the inevitability of human genetic enhancement. And that book has been published in 16 languages and is a frequently cited text for future techno-utopian thought. Dr. Silver's newest book is Challenging Nature, The Clash of Science and Spirituality at the New Frontiers of Life. Welcome, Lee Silver.
Good to be here.
Is this book, in some sense, a response to Remaking Eden? Because with Remaking Eden, it was such a controversial book for its time, and you took a lot of hammer blows from people who thought that you were arguing for genetic engineering in ways that they didn't agree with. So is Challenging Nature a response to those criticisms?
That was one of the things that led to current book. The negative response I got to Remaking Eden, I wanted to understand why so many people were so offended or afraid by the technologies in Remaking Eden, why so many people were angry at me. And that led me to a whole other study outside of the world of biology to try to understand how people think about life and how many people have religious beliefs that conflict with advances in technology. So that was one component of my new book.
So that it's such a hot time to do that kind of investigation because there's so many folks trying to apply an evolutionary psychology explanation to why people have religious beliefs and where our religious beliefs come from. So you were compelled by the material that you gathered in that investigation?
Yes. I mean, what compelled me the most was just the negative response to Remaking Eden. And so what I did was rather than just look at the books that describe religious beliefs that other people may or may not hold, I decided to travel around the world with my family, actually talk to people, find out what they thought. I mean, biotechnology clearly is very different than other technologies because it's the only technology that manipulates life. And people in every society, including our own, have very particular views of life, often spiritual views of life, in a way that they don't see other kinds of objects which aren't biological.
So in the book, you parse out Eastern and Western ideas about and other kinds of ideas about the nature of humanness and the specialness of whether we have souls or not, and how those shape our attitudes towards biotechnology. Can you flesh out a little bit of that argument for us?
Sure. What I discovered, actually, in traveling through the East is how different most of the people who live in Asia think about spirits and souls than people who were brought up in the West. In the West, people are brought up in a Judeo-Christian culture, and those who stick to it, who are traditional Christians, are people who believe in that human beings have souls, that there's a single God, and there's a future plan for the world. In Asia, and in a very different way, there is no single God. People may believe in many gods or no God, but there's no such thing as a single God creator who has control over everything. And the other thing that is very different about Asia is that people make their own futures. They don't think that there's no single God, and the gods aren't making the future for you. Individuals, by the way they live their lives, make their own futures. And that has a huge effect on how people think about biotechnology, because in the West, traditional Christians and what I call post-Christians in the book all think that there is a God either in heaven or a God of Mother Nature that we are offending some way by using technology, and that in some way we're going to destroy this future that's already been set up. And they just don't think that way in the East, so they don't have as much of a problem with these technologies as people in the West do.
We're speaking with Dr. Lee Silver and talking about his book, Challenging Nature, The Clash of Science and Spirituality at the New Frontiers of Life, which just came out. And what you're saying about the East-West, it sounds cliche to some, but all the survey research really does support this, because there's much broader support for the use of biotechnology, both on human beings, animals, and plants in India, every place from India over to Japan, you know,
that
whole swath.
If you look right now at the data on which countries have national laws which either support embryo stem cell research and cloning, for example, versus those that have national laws that ban it, what you find is that all of the Asian countries that are non-Christian, including India and China and Japan, South Korea, Singapore, even Indonesia, all of these countries are supporting this kind of research. And in the Western Hemisphere, there's not a single country that supports embryo cloning, for example. The United States, of course, has no national laws, but there's no country in this hemisphere that supports the research completely. And, of course, the Western Hemisphere is the most Christian part of the world.
Well, Lee, the only reason we don't have laws banning cloning or other kinds of biotech here is because we worship mammon as often as we worship Yahweh. Right? Isn't it the biotech lobby in Congress that has kept all those laws from being passed here?
Yeah, so what happens in the United States is that the easiest path is the status quo at the national level. So no laws are made either supporting or denying things like cloning. But that means that there's no federal funds available, as you know, for embryo cloning. But private companies can do it if they choose.
So your idea about the nature of humans' role in the world and whether there's a divine prescription for what we're supposed to do, I mean, clearly there are in some Eastern religions like Hinduism divine prescriptions, but I think one of the interesting things is whether there's a static view of nature or not. Like in right. Hinduism and Buddhism, there's much more of a dynamic understanding of humans' evolution towards something better.
Yes, I mean, I think that's another huge difference between the East and the West. In the East, Hinduism, Buddhism, the other kinds of religions there, see human spirits, as evolving entities. And the idea is that spirits start off in a simple form, maybe in a simple animal, and then the body wears out and they reincarnate into a new body, which might be at a higher level, until they finally reach human beings. And then some people think that human beings reincarnate continuously, and some people think that human beings eventually reach nirvana. But there is this evolutionary process going on in the East.
There are Christian theologians who are trying to make this argument. There's the school of co-creator theology, but
yeah,
they're very, very few, and it is a much harder case to make when you just read the mythopoetics of Judaism and Christianity at face value, and then you compare it to Hinduism and Buddhism at face value. It's much harder to argue that there was any intent of Yahweh for us to take an active role in changing nature.
Right. I mean, and if you go back to Genesis, it's very clear that in the Judeo-Christian tradition, all of the animals, plants, and human beings were all created as they are now. I mean, God created the animals to reproduce their own kind, not to evolve. So, I mean, the current people who are trying to take that that tradition and change it, I mean, that's not exactly traditional Christianity anymore when you're talking about self-evolving or evolving plants and animals.
Right. There's another interesting aspect to this, and I remember I heard you talk about your book in Oxford, where we had this meeting about human enhancement, and there was an obligatory representative of the developing world who was a man from India who kept intoning phrases about how Indians have a different perspective about this and that. And I finally got fed up, and I don't know if you were there, but I said to him, you know, look, Indians polled are twice as supportive of the use of human genetic engineering on their children as people in any Western country are. Yeah. And, so don't give me that. And in your religious pantheon, you have human-animal chimeras. You know, I think you have a whole chapter here about human-animal, you know, the divisions between humans and animals. And I think that that's another interesting case is that, you know, there are some cultures that don't have as much ritual pollution around the notion of humans and animals being mixed.
Yes, that's exactly right. And of course, whenever you have a self-proclaimed spokesperson for a tradition like Hinduism, there's no guarantee, and usually that person doesn't really represent what the people in his country think. I mean, that's what happened with crop biotechnology in the 1990s. There were some very radical advocates against the use of crop biotechnology in India. But when the people discovered how powerful the technologies were, they overcame these so-called spokespersons. And
Vandana Shiva. I mean,
Vandana Shiva. She's an excellent example of somebody who claims to represent Indian thought, and she doesn't.
Right. Any biotech activist in the West will know Vandana Shiva's name, but no one in India would have a clue who she was.
That's exactly right. And so a lot of people in the West get confused because they think they're listening to spokespeople for Asian countries, and they're really not.
Okay, so this attitude is also being subtly manipulated by secular progressives on the left who, in my book Citizen Cyborg, I argue that part of the postmodern condition is that secular progressives have been casting about for some ground on which to base their ethics and their, you know, they have the same loss of meaning and sense of purpose that many people feel.
Right.
And they have latched onto, as you put it, Gaia mother worship, or, you know, these other kind of pre-modern notions of, well, there's a natural order out there and we have to protect the natural order. And for them, it's not God, but it's just a different word, which functions in the same way.
Yeah. And I think that's what's happened in the West specifically because Western culture is permeated with Judeo-Christian underpinning. People who grow up in the West have this monotheistic view of the world. They're very unlikely to think of multiple gods. And so when people, especially in Europe, reject the God of the Bible, very often they find comfort in replacing that single God with the God of Mother Earth or the God of the universe. And so they think they're not being religious when, in fact, they are. They've just replaced one God with another God who has to be obeyed.
Jeremy Rifkin plays a pretty central role in this whole history because of all the cynical manipulators of, you know, secular progressives on the one hand and religious on the other. He has been the most, in some ways, the most honest, but in other ways, the most manipulative of the coalition builders, you know, saying, okay, well, we disagree about everything in our worldview, but let's get together and fight this particular biotech thing, and then maybe we can figure out why we agree on that.
And Jeremy Rifkin is actually not very consistent in why he opposes technology. Sometimes he sounds almost Christian-like in his opposition to embryo research.
His opposition to species boundaries being violated was...
Right, and the opposition to species boundaries is complete scientific ignorance. I mean, it's a pre-Darwinian picture of the world in which every species is completely separate from every other species. So a lot of what Jeremy Rifkin says is based on scientific ignorance. And specifically, scientific ignorance of the role that human beings have already played in completely modifying the biosphere as we know it and planting crops and developing domesticated animals. And Rifkin doesn't seem to understand any of that.
A lot of the politics and activism that I've been doing over the last 15 years around biotechnology and bioregulation, I keep coming back to the Enlightenment, because for me it seems like the Enlightenment looms ever larger as this unique confluence of ideas about science and democracy and the kind of civilization that we want to build and the idea of progress to begin right. with. And I'll acknowledge that many of those things can be found in other cultures. The idea of progress can be found in other cultures. The idea of science can be found in other cultures. But there is, for me, an historical uniqueness. Do you see through this investigation that what we're really talking about is the ongoing struggle for the Enlightenment?
Oh, absolutely. If that's what's happening in the West, we have postmodern historians who are anti-Enlightenment, people like Jeremy Rifkin who are anti-Enlightenment. I think there's this, an enormous amount of ignorance when these people claim they want to live in the way that our ancestors lived hundreds or thousands of years ago, that they don't need or use technology. I just think that's thinking with blinders on. It's really quite amazing. But as you say, I mean, this argument, this debate and battle has been going on now since the beginning of the Enlightenment a few hundred years ago. I mean, you have the Enlightenment, and then you have the anti-Enlightenment romanticists who romanticize Mother Nature is what they're doing today. So it's an ongoing argument. I don't know how it's ever going to end in the West.
I'm speaking with Professor Lee Silver. He's a geneticist at Princeton University, and he's written a book called Challenging Nature, The Clash of Science and Spirituality at the New Frontiers of Life. Very provocative book about why various people have problems with biotechnology. Let's also ask, well, given the values of the Enlightenment and given your own understanding of the threats and potential problems of biotechnology, mm-hmm. you know, how much ground do we need to give right off the bat and say, yes, there is a potential for bioterrorism, there is a potential for genetic pollution, there is a potential for this and that, but your approach is what? Your approach is
my,
not
my
helpful.
My approach is to say, well, I don't speak in the book about bioterrorism per se. I mean, clearly that's a potential problem. I look at things that really are right in our faces and we don't recognize them, like the fact that we use 38% of the world's land mass in agriculture, and every time we plant a plot of crops, we're taking away an ecosystem. We're destroying it. Most people don't realize that all of Europe is covered with agricultural animals and plants that just didn't exist there before human beings existed there.
I just want to dilate on that point for a second, because whenever I argue with people about agricultural biotechnology, I say, mm-hmm. look, if we want to feed more people with less forests being cut down, as you just said, yep. we have to grow more food on the same amount of land. And there's
less
only
plants, even. I mean, I'm an optimist. So, yeah. so I would say that we should grow all the food we need on the least land possible to reduce the human footprint on the biosphere.
And no-till agriculture and organic methods just won't get us there.
No, they won't get us there. Certainly they won't get us there. And it won't get us there either to just sort of do this all haphazardly and think that Mother Nature is going to take care of us, because it's much, much more effective to look at the world, understand how we've completely altered the world landscape, and talk about what we find valuable or not, and try to preserve what we find valuable. I think wilderness is valuable to humankind, and the best way to preserve wilderness is just basically to limit the amount of land we farm, and that's perfectly clear.
Do you do biotech research? You're a human person, right? You work on humans.
No, actually, all of my research was on mice. So I did. Mice are kind of like little humans, but yes, I did genetic engineering and embryo research. Using mice as a model system for humans.
Have you thought about submitting a mouse model to the Methuselah Mouse Prize? you know about this, right?
Yes, I do.
The longest-lived mouse gets to win every year?
Right, exactly. Well, I mean, there's no reason why, with genetic engineering and genetic knowledge, we can't extend the life of a mouse from its normal 2 to 3 years as far as we want. I mean, that's the fascinating thing about our ability to understand how living things work, which goes completely against the Christian idea that life will always be a mystery to us.
I was reading your book, and there are so many absurd arguments in this debate, but the one that often comes up when you talk about genetic engineering is the notion of monocropping of species or monocropping of human beings, that we would all have exactly the same genomes, and therefore we would all be susceptible to the same diseases, or we would suddenly discover that we had engineered out our capacity to have malaria, and therefore we wouldn't have something valuable in the future. And it, you know, it's just so absurd, because if we had the capacity to do that kind of engineering, we could fix it.
Exactly, we could. And there's never going to be a monoculture of either human beings or crops. What's interesting to me is that I heard all of these activists talking about crop monocultures and how the world is going to be destroyed by a famine. And when I looked into it, I discovered that they were just simply wrong. That if you look at corn in the United States, there are hundreds of different varieties of corn that grow best in different climates, like North Dakota versus Georgia, which seem obvious to us. And so this notion of a monoculture is a notion of pure ignorance. It's, again, people speaking on behalf of farmers when they know nothing about farming.
Right. And just another example is that Brave New World has become a shorthand for the notion of human engineering. But what was so horrifying about Brave New World was that there was this acceptance that there had to be these separate castes of intelligence.
Right.
So then when I say to people, okay, well, in the future, do you think that most parents would choose to have bright kids or dumb kids if they had the option? Well, most parents would choose to have smart kids. And then that's a problem, because why? Well, then we would lose the diversity of the human race, because we wouldn't have dumb people anymore. So basically, you want to preserve a society, you biotech opponent, in which there are smart people and dumb people, but you think we might have a society in which there's only smart people, and they don't see the contradiction. You know, it's basically
they don't see the contradictions, and they don't realize that in a certain sense we are the smartest. We are all smart survivors from Homo erectus and our ancestors. You know, all the dumb ones, they died off. They're gone. They're the species that are no longer here. And so in a society where everybody is healthy and everybody has a high level of intelligence, there's going to be much more diversity. And that's the way I see it, and I know that's the way you see it as well.
Yeah. I taught infectious disease public policy this semester for the first time, and it was just fascinating. We had a specialist come in to talk about parasitic diseases and how many people historically, paleolithically, and contemporary have had intestinal worms, carried
right.
You know, a load of intestinal worms. And it turns out to be, you know, quite a large percentage of our ancestors and still quite a few people around the world today.
Yeah.
And when you have these intestinal worms developmentally, it stunts your growth and it stunts your intelligence. It lowers your IQ by 10 to 15 points.
Right.
So, you know, just simply by not having had intestinal worms, you know, we're significantly different. Our life prospects, our height, our health is significantly different from our ancestors. People seem to romanticize what it was like to be a Paleolithic hunter-gatherer. It's just absurd.
Well, I think the other problem that people have, which took a long time to discover by me, is that people are just very scared that we're going to change the nature of human beings, as Francis Fukuyama says, post-human. And they're scared about it, I think, subliminally in many cases, because of this idea that Jesus Christ is representative of human beings and God created human beings in his image. And the idea that we can go beyond that is frightening. Now, a lot of people don't think of that consciously, but subconsciously there's this idea God created us and we should stick with what God gave us and we shouldn't try to better God.
I've certainly seen that.
And that's one of the things I try to bring out in my book.
I've certainly seen that argument from Christian theologians, that the attempts at human enhancement, they say things like, well, when Jesus comes back, will he recognize who we are?
Right, exactly.
We were saying people he left.
Right. And I think the problem in society today is that many of these religious arguments are being sublimated below the surface. And so the anti-technology activists and others who may be driven by religious or spiritual views don't use those views to try to convince other people of what they think is right in life. I mean, they try to use science and end up being very pseudoscientific in their attempt to convince people to follow the worldview that they have.
Okay, but let me bring it back here in the last couple of minutes to
sure.
The question. You got whacked pretty hard in your previous book for appearing to be sanguine about the prospect of radical class divides and genetic divides in society. I don't think you were, but that's what people interpreted some of the comments as.
Right.
And this book and this argument can sound, as I have sounded to others I know, as if I'm just saying, oh, you're just a bunch of irrational crazies and you don't actually have any reason to be concerned about biotech. All of your concerns are just irrationality. So I mean, let's, you know, put again on the table. We need to have an EPA. We need to have an FDA. We need to have a regulatory process. We need to have, you know, good science being done. It, all of the concerns are legitimate questions to ask, except when they get into these theological realms.
Right. That's right. People misinterpreted my previous book. I was very ambivalent because of my fear that society would be divided into two parts, but I also thought that people should have the liberty to give their children advantages. What I've seen in the last 10 years, I mean, I've learned a lot more about politics and how things move, is that giving people the liberty to better their lives often will come down and help everybody in that society. I mean, I really do hope that in the future these technologies can be available to everyone, that all of society will benefit from it. And I think everybody will, except for those who have religious beliefs that won't allow them to use it.
Well, what's astonishing about the doublethink around that argument is that I don't see any of those same activists arguing that we shouldn't have tried to give antiretroviral therapy to people in sub-Saharan Africa or that we should have banned it in the North until everyone could have had it. And I don't see them arguing against the $100 laptop and saying we should ban computers until everybody can have a computer. They argue for, in fact, how we can expand access to these technologies in the developing world and to
the
poor.
Yes, that's the way they argue now, but we should remember that Jeremy Rifkin wrote a book called The End of Work, which is based on the idea that if we computerize the workplace, everybody would have nothing to do, and society would collapse. And
He wasn't terribly opposed to it. He just thought we could all get jobs in the nonprofit sector, because he had. he had found success there, so he thought that was an avenue. Well, this is a fascinating project, and you are a very provocative and fascinating thinker. We've been talking with Professor Lee Silver, who's written Challenging Nature, The Clash of Science and Spirituality at the New Frontiers of Life. And you're traveling around and speaking about this book. Are you working on another project?
One of the things I'm actually working on is we were given a commission by the Guthrie Theater, myself and a playwright, to write a play about the student I had who wanted to become pregnant with a chimp sperm and the quandaries over what that hybrid organism inside her would be. So that's one of the projects I'm most interested in right now.
That is absolutely fascinating. We've been debating a lot at the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, the ethics of human-animal chimera, and in particular, ape uplift projects, you know, attempts to change the cognitive function of apes.
Right.
It's just,
right.
It's such a hot topic right now.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, and I encourage everyone to go out and read Challenging Nature and take a look at Lee Silver's website, which I will again say is leemsilver.net.
Well, thank you very much, James. Good talking to you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@IEET.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at IEET.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.